much. I always enjoyed the Bell special. I think we have another one even tomorrow night for our Christmas Eve service, so looking for that tomorrow. All right, a few different places we're going to read here to start off with. We're going to start off in Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1, you can turn there. I'm going to read two other verses before I get to Luke, and then I'll read in Luke. Isaiah 7:14. Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. But thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from old, from everlasting. Luke chapter 1, we're going to switch over to the birth of John the Baptist, not the birth of Christ. Luke chapter 1, starting in verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the course of Abia, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. They had no child, because that Elizabeth was barren, and they both were now well stricken in years. And it came to pass that while he executed the priest office before God in the order of his course, according to the custom of the priest office, his lot was to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. So we learn a lot about Zacharias and his work and the exact time that this was taking place. While the multitude of the people were praying without at the time of incense, there appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing on the right hand of the altar of incense. And when Zacharias saw him, he was troubled, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, for thy prayer is heard, and thy wife Elizabeth shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John. Now let's jump down to verse 23. And it came to pass that as soon as the days of his ministration were accomplished, he departed to his own house. This is, I guess I called him Zach a couple Sundays, so we're going to call him Zach and Lizzie now. I've been hearing that at my house all week, so it's no longer Zacharias and Elizabeth. It is now Zach and Lizzie, apparently. He went to his own house, verse 24, and after those days, his wife Elizabeth conceived and hid herself 5 months. All right, let's go ahead and pray. Father in heaven, Lord, I ask your blessing upon the message and the teaching tonight. Lord, I pray that you would instruct us in your word, and Lord, help us to even increase our faith and what we can see, what you're in control of, and Lord, how organized the Bible is, and how this isn't just a book of men, but Lord, your hand is on this. This is, in fact, your word. So Lord, strengthen us tonight and draw us closer to you. Lord, I love you, and I pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Of course, there's a lot of prophecies about Jesus Christ. There's probably about 300 altogether in the Bible concerning him one way or another. Some of the most popular I've already read, such as Micah 5:2, dealing with where he would be born. That would be Bethlehem. Isaiah 7:14, a virgin would conceive. We see in Genesis 3:15 is the very first promise to be of the seed of woman. So we also, another indication of a virgin birth there, just not quite as clear until we get to Isaiah 7:14. And then Genesis chapter 49, we have more information given about the Messiah when he would come. He'd be of the tribe of Judah. So we have that. A virgin would conceive. It'd be in the town of Bethlehem. He was going to be ruler. There's other prophecies as well, such as even the killing of the infants, that when Herod went ahead and killed all the children trying to kill Jesus Christ. Jeremiah chapter 31 is a prophecy about that. And so what I want to do first before we get into the time in December 25th, is I want to talk a little bit about something I also think is needed this time, is the statistical probability that Jesus Christ could fulfill these prophecies. It really is incredible. Now, there's no question in anybody's mind about when the Bible was written, each of the books. That's not in question at all. So we know when the books of the Old Testament were written. We know when the books of the New Testament were written. And it's interesting to see, it's more than interesting to see, it's just astounding when you begin to think about Jesus Christ fulfilling those prophecies that were written in the Old Testament. So, we're going to talk about a word called probability. Probability is the same thing as odds. What are the odds of something happening? Probability, though, has its own math and things like that, with its own measures of the likelihood of any given event when it will occur. And so, let me give you some different statistics that are out there. The likelihood of you being struck by lightning is 1 in 700,000. The likelihood of lightning killing you, actually, that increases to about 1 in 2 million. I don't tell you you'd survive that. That's pretty amazing. Becoming president, 1 in 10 million. If you're Donald Trump, that was probably 1 in 100 million that would happen. And it really is incredible. A meteorite landing on your house. I have no idea what this number is, and neither do you. It's 1 with about 13 zeros behind it. Whatever number, 18 with then about 13 zeros behind it. That's the likelihood of a meteorite hitting your house. The fact that you will die. Anybody know what that stat is? 1 in 1. You're good. Good. So anyhow, you can see with different things the idea of probability, how it comes into play. So we want to try and apply the mathematics of probability to what the prophecies concerning Jesus Christ and the likelihood or probability of any one man being able to fulfill those prophecies. There's 300 altogether, and not just counting his birth, of course, but dealing with the Messiah himself. And we're just going to look at a small portion of them. And again, this information, by the way, as far as the coming in on the probability, is coming from a book, Science Speaks. And he was the one who actually did the math on this. I certainly did not. So he broke it down in looking at 8 different prophecies, all right? And so the math is fairly simple. He looked at the prophecies of if they were just filled individually, all right? If, in other words, if Christ was just born in Bethlehem, what's the statistically likelihood of that taking place? By itself, it might not all seem that grand. Where it begins to multiply to an astronomical level is when you begin putting prophecy on top of prophecy on top of prophecy. That's when it gets statistically astounding. Okay? And so the likelihood of him being born in Bethlehem is 1 in 280,000. It doesn't seem that much. The prophecy about the forerunner of Christ, this is the second of 8 that he used. That would be 1 in 1,000. Christ entering Jerusalem riding on a donkey, 1 in 100. Christ to be betrayed by a friend, 1 in 1,000. Christ to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, 1 in 1,000. 30 pieces of silver casted down and used by a potter's field, 1 in 100,000. The fact that Christ kept silent when on trial, that prophecy, Isaiah 53, I should give out all these references, I'm sorry, I have them all written out, I didn't give anyone out. That's Isaiah 53:7, fulfilled Mark chapter 14, that is 1 in 1,000. The fact that he was crucified, Psalm 22, that's when that is prophesied, fulfilled obviously in all the Gospels, that is 1 in 10,000, when they look at statistical probability. So, any of those individually don't look that amazing, but when you begin to put just 8 of them together of one man, that happens to fit all 8 of those. That's where it gets incredible. And this is just 8. There's much, much, much more than 8. He just did the math on 8. And what's the probability of one man fitting each one of those prophecies that was there? So, I got to figure out how many there are here. It would be 1 in 28 zeros behind it. That's the likelihood of fulfilling the probability of any one man being able to fulfill 8 of those prophecies by probability. So, in other words, the point is this. That's just 8. Just looking at 8 of the prophecies, it's beyond probability. It's beyond, in other words, God's in it. There's no question when you look at any one man being able to fulfill any of those. If you look at him individually, it's not that astounding. But when you look at him fulfilling all of them, and we just looked at 8. Imagine increasing that number more and more. How much more that's going to just climb and climb. So it really is incredible, especially when you look at the timing between the span of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Of course, we have the 400 years of no writing whatsoever. And then the timing of the New Testament from Genesis. You know, we're dealing with a 4,000-year time period as far as history-wise. And then a 2,000 time period, 2,500 time period from the actual writing of the Old Testament. Really is absolutely incredible. And that takes none of those things into probability. So it really is incredible, especially when we look at how Jesus Christ fulfilled all those prophecies, where you can see God is in it. It really is incredible. Now, let's get into the main thing I want to talk about here, and that is the timing of Jesus Christ's birth. Now, again, to start this off with, I don't know what day Jesus Christ was born. I don't know it. I've always heard it taught that it was never December 25th, that it was likely to have been in spring or fall. And I've never heard that broken out. That's just what I heard. I usually hear a statement something like this, based on the shepherds in the field, the likelihood that he was born would have been either fall or spring, but never studied it out. That's all I heard. However, we celebrate the date on December 25th. So let's take a look and see how all that came about and see if there's any scripture behind it. Now, many believe that this date was picked by the Roman Catholic Church to celebrate the pagan holiday of a Hindu sun god. That was to take place. They had a feast week that would take place, and the birthday of this sun god was December 25th. So they believed, and the Roman Catholic Church was known for that. They certainly would compromise with pagan religions in mixing it. That's the common thing. I remember I read that several times, that it was just a Roman Catholic date picked. It dealt with paganism, and I went with that. A lot of times that is where we make a mistake. We'll read something and just assume it with one paragraph, one statement, with nothing really to back it up and never research it. Was that all there was to December 25th? Just that fact that took place. And we find when you actually study it, that is not the case at all. There was also a Roman festival at the same time, which also sort of many people led to December 25th, and that was worshiping of the Roman god Saturn, whose also birthday they proclaimed was December 25th. I find it interesting to me, almost as another proof of all these fake gods that this devil's throwing on December 25th. I do. I find that interesting. So you had the pagan religion. The Romans had that. They thought December 25th was the winter solstice. They were wrong, of course. It's actually going to be, December 21st. One of my favorite things about Christmas in Alaska is we've gained 4 days of daylight already. And then the Roman emperor in 274, he was the one who proclaimed this great holiday about December 25th with the Roman god Saturn. And there's where you're going to get some of your tie-in with the Roman Catholic Church. That would be coming into play. But is there anything in records that show Christians recognizing December 25th and before the year 274? That would be interesting. If we have something on record that Christians that were meeting had somehow recognized that the birth of Christ was somewhere near December 25th, that would be, because then it's before this debate. So do we have that on record? We do. Well, before December 25th, there's writings around 200 AD of Christians referring to the birth of Christ around December 25th. So that is well before a lot of these activities came about dealing with the god Saturn that they were worshiping and the Hindu sun god as well. Again, too often people just read something, they latch onto it without researching it, and so people start teaching that December 25th, it was just a pagan holiday, the Catholic Church compromised, and we're just celebrating a pagan holiday. But again, we have it in writing, before any of these events took place, that there were Christians that were recognizing the birth of Christ around December 25th. So the question is, why? Why would they recognize that? And that's what we want to look at. Now, it's true that in the 4th century, when Christians began to celebrate Christmas, there's a difference between recognizing the date that he was born and then actually celebrating it. Do you understand? Where it's a holiday. That was looked on as pagan by most of the Christians. That was not looked on as... But there's a difference between celebrating it and recognizing it as the day he was born. All right. 4th century, there began a celebration with it. And so obviously a lot of Christians that were trying to stay true, especially away from the Roman Catholic influence that was growing, didn't want to celebrate because you had so many pagan feasts going on with the sun god. They didn't want to associate with that. But that doesn't mean that December 25th did not already have validity within the Christian community as to the birth of Jesus Christ. Even early days in America, if you remember that, Christmas was pretty much banned to celebrate because it was viewed as a Roman Catholic holiday. But the date does have merit as to the birth of Jesus Christ. So let's look at that date a little bit more closely. Now we read from Luke chapter 1 as to the birth of John the Baptist, when he was going to be born. Now that's important. We also have to take into account the Hebrew calendar as compared to our calendar today. That's also going to be a player in this. The Hebrew calendar had 354 days, not 365 days. So their calendar does not exactly line up with ours as we use it. And so that's becomes a player in this a little bit. The Hebrew month, we know Nisan, roughly corresponds from mid-March to mid-April. When we look at the Hebrew calendar, it's usually mid-month to mid-month compared to our calendar, from their start compared to our start. And so, but anyhow, the Hebrew month, Nisan, that would correspond from mid-March to mid-April. It's in this month that they celebrate Passover and Israel's deliverance from Egypt. The first month of the Hebrew religious year is the month Nisan. Now, we need to know that first month. We need to know when they begin that, if we can begin a foundation of when Jesus Christ was born. So, the priests who served in the temple when they served was established by a pattern given by King David. Let's turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 24. They were divided into 24, as far as those who were Levites, they were divided into 24 groups, and they would serve two roles, governors of the sanctuary and governors of the house of God. We're going to see that. Each group of priests served according to a schedule drawn up by casting of lots. We see that taking place in that chapter. All right, so understand here. So there's responsibilities that are divided out within the different families that are Levites of who is going to serve in the sanctuary in the temple, what's going to be of the work that needs to be done. So they divide them up into 24 different groups, and each of those families is going to be assigned a time slot that was decided by the casting of lots of when they would serve. And that continued down from generation to generation. They never changed what happened here in 1 Chronicles. Oh, let me get there. I'm in the wrong book altogether. Chapter 24. So, but we need to read there a little bit. All right, let's see. Let's jump down to verse 3 a little bit. And David distributed them both, Zadok of the sons of Eleazar and Ahimelech of the sons of Ithamar, according to their offices and their service. And there were more chief men found of the sons of Eleazar than of the sons of Ithamar. And thus were they divided among the sons of Eleazar. There were 16 chief men of the house of their fathers and 8 among their sons of Ithamar. We're getting up to 24 now. According to the house of their fathers. Verse 5. They were divided by lot, one sort with another, for the governors of the sanctuary, the governors of the house of God, were the sons of Eleazar and the sons of Ithamar put together. And anyhow, it divides it up a little bit more there. Then I need to drop down to verse 10. These are the different families. These family groups, this is when they're going to serve. So the eighth lot, or that eighth month, is going to be to Abijah. All right, that's when he's going to end up serving. And they had the two different groups, so you'd have 24, each 12 and 12 for the different responsibilities that they would have divided into their calendar. So Abijah was assigned the eighth course. That means that the descendants of Abijah, they would fulfill their duties to serve in the eighth month. That's when they're going to be serving. All right, so that takes us back to Luke chapter 1. Now let's go back to Luke chapter 1. Because if we can establish a time frame of when John the Baptist is born, you're going to see we can establish a time frame of when Jesus Christ was born. So Zechariah, he is serving, and we know what family he is of and when he was serving. Verse 5. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the course of Abia, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. So we know that John the Baptist was serving in that eighth course, according to 1 Chronicles 24:10. That's when he was there. So we know the exact time frame when Zacharias was serving, doing his responsibility as a priest. All right, so he is going to be in the temple in the eighth month of the Hebrew calendar. So when is that? That corresponds from mid-October to mid-November in the calendar. That's when he would. That's somewhere in that time frame, given a two-week schedule. That's when he's going to be serving. He would fulfill his normal term of service. He was fulfilling his normal term of service when Gabriel appeared unto him. We read that in the text. So this is when he appears to him. We know it's in that time frame. So we're going to be dealing with the from mid-October to the end of October. Somewhere in that time frame is when Gabriel appeared unto Zacharias. One of those days in there. That's when he appeared to him. And he let him know that his wife Elizabeth was going to bear a son. This would be the forerunner of Jesus Christ. So, Zacharias would have completed his service and gone home between the middle and end of October. Whenever his service of his term was divided up, he would have traveled home at that time. And the Bible tells us that he stayed and completed his normal duties even after he was informed from Gabriel. All right, and before returning home, we read that in verse 23. It was shortly after his return, we see that the Bible tells us that his wife conceived as promised by the angel. So it is very likely that she would have conceived immediately. The promise is given. He heads home. I don't think there's much delay there. All right. I don't think he waited a few weeks or anything like that. I think the likelihood was it was immediate upon returning home, which could easily have been him going in for 2 weeks with what he was doing and then back home somewhere around the very end of October, around October 31st. Okay. And so anyhow, that's more than likely when the conception of John the Baptist took place. And that gives us a lot of information. All right. If in fact there was no delay, now the Bible doesn't tell us there wasn't going to be any delay, but it certainly isn't without basis to assume that it happened immediately when he returned. Okay, so if she conceives immediately upon when he returns, again we have an idea. That's the very end of October. So let's go back into our reading and pick up where we left off in Luke chapter 1. So John returns and lets us know that she does conceive. Verse 23, he goes home. The very next verse, another clue that it was immediate. Elizabeth is pregnant. She hid herself 5 months, though. So she hid herself 5 months. And thus saith the Lord, dealt with me. This is her speaking in the days when he looked upon me to take away my reproach among men. Because she was no longer barren, she could have a child. And in the sixth month, well, what does that mean? It's still referring back to Elizabeth. In the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, the angel Gabriel was sent from God unto the city of Galilee, named Nazareth, to a virgin espoused to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David, and of the virgin's name was Mary. And the angel came and lets her know, you know, thou art favored among women, and you're going to conceive the Messiah, the Son of the Highest, the Son of the Most High, the Son of God. A virgin would conceive takes place. So what we know is this: is that when Elizabeth gets pregnant when John returns. Let's say that's the very end of October, October 31st, that he gets back home. She gets pregnant. It's 6 months later when Mary is notified of the angel that she is going to be with child and she's going to carry the Messiah. That is going to be at the very end of March. It's going to be the very end of March when that took place, when Mary would have been notified. It was at that time that Gabriel announced to Mary that she would be the mother of the Messiah. And so normal gestation for a human baby is 270 days. It's 270 days. It's normal gestation, that exact amount of days. So if the angel Gabriel made his announcement to Mary somewhere close to March 31st on our calendar, if you add 270 days to that day, guess what date that is? December 25th. That falls on December 25th. And so that's the biblical, and there's more. I'm going to cover a few other things that also point to that scripturally. That's not the only thing in scripture, but that's the strongest, all right? Because we do know when John the Baptist was serving, it does tell us that when he went home, the very next verse says Elizabeth is pregnant. She hid herself 5 months, so it's at her sixth month that the angel appears unto Mary. We have that down pat. That's going to be the end of March. 270 days later is December 25th, mid-December. So I think that's also likely of why we see in early Christian writings, before all the pagan holidays came up, of Christians referencing, and there was different references at the time when I was studying this out. This would have been last year more. I didn't do that this year, but last year studying out more is interesting because they did fluctuate a little bit between December, mid-December, December 25th into early January even, where some other dates speculating, but they were always coming back to right around December 25th. It was always around that time frame though. And so we see that. So again, normal gestation, 270 days from March 31st, 270 days you add to that is December 25th. And so anyhow, I think there's very good reason to see that it is perhaps a very likely day that Christ was born. But then we have the fact of the shepherds in the field. What does that tell us? The fact that the shepherds were in the field. And that does speak to the fact that it is likely that the ewes were ready to give birth, that it was time for the delivery of them because they were in the field. It was at night. So that is a likely assumption. So the question comes into play, when do they usually do that? Is it spring or fall, or when does that take place? And so, but here's what we do know, is that, let me read this here. Ewes commonly become pregnant, this is, I'm quoting from another source, in July, just after the summer solstice. Okay, normal gestation for them is 5 months. That means that 5 months from right around the 1st of July, guess where that's going to put it? From summer solstice to that time, mid-December. Mid-December would also be the time that when they would be having the babies and ready to go. So the shepherds would likely be in the field. So that also lines up with Scripture. This is also related. Stormer also referred to this in his book, dealing with different ranchers in the States that did talk about that, how December would be a time for those lambs to be born. And shepherds would, again, they usually stay out in the field at night when that was going to be taking place, make sure there's no problems, make sure they didn't lose any, and to be helped however they could. So we have two different things that are verifying the fact that it is likely to have been mid-December. December 25th, somewhere in that range. Again, we have, and I also find it interesting, again, that there's writings well before 270 within Christendom, within that early time frame of referencing that. Now, it didn't come about until the 12th century when that got questioned, actually. All right? You got to jump. I don't have my notes on that, but I know it was in the 12th century. It wasn't until the 12th century that timing was questioned. That's a long time. All right, that's a long time, and it got questioned not because it was notes in a Bible. Was there notes in a Bible or some type of theological book that was written? There was a side note that was written questioning the date of December 25th. That got ran with, but anyhow, it wasn't even questioned until right around the 12th century as far as the timing of it. Now, again, that didn't mean Christians were celebrating it because of the different sun gods and different things like that were taking place. Many did avoid it. It wasn't because they questioned the date. It was because what was associated with the event. Does that make sense? All right. And so anyhow, I certainly find it interesting. I think another thing that, and this I added to the lesson last year, just made sense to me, maybe just living in Alaska. I think I also find it interesting because at this time frame, it's the darkest time of the year, Northern Hemisphere. It's the darkest time of the year. It just makes sense that that's when God would send the Messiah, during the darkest time of the year, to send the light of the world and allow that birth take place. So anyhow, I hope you found that interesting. I always have. I think there's a lot of validity to the fact of December 25th, and I don't question the fact of the different pagan gods, the sun god that had. They also celebrated his birth on December 25th, and I don't question the fact that the Roman Catholic Church also would mix paganism in with Christianity. That certainly took place, but that doesn't mean you just dismiss it because of that. We have to see, is there anything to it scripturally? And when you study it out, I don't think you can come out with any other time frame of his birth, but coming to sometime around December 25th or maybe a couple of weeks later, depending on when Elizabeth conceived. So anyhow, there's also different things. I'm not going to get into it tonight for time's sake. Of the Christmas tree, there's a lot of different origins about that. That does have some Christian background, but maybe next year I'll tie that in a little bit. And there's always things about that people like to run to Isaiah and claim that's it, that we're worshiping a pagan god as well when we're doing that. Yet there's strong Christian influence behind that. That too. And so, if you don't believe that, I'm fine with it. That's up to you. But there is a Christian theme behind that as well. It wasn't just arbitrary. Again, sometimes we just read something, we grab it, and we hold on to it without ever substantiating what's behind it. And sometimes we like to do that a little too much. All right. Let's go.